Homestuck Made This World Bonusodes. Bonus. Wah. I'm Michael. Oh.
Wah.
Some sort of penguin.
I'm a whole city. That's the joke.
That's the joke.
Kazoo!
I'm a little Jim Henson guy. Don't introduce yourself. I'm a little Jim Henson guy.
Okay.
From you're the Dark Crystal.
Uh-huh.
I'm one of those.
Okay, you're a little Jim Henson guy. I'm unintroduced. We're talking about Detective Pony.
Mm-hmm. This is our new sub-podcast. Unannounced and Jim Henson. No, it's like Jesus versus Mero, so it's unannounced versus little Jim Henson guy.
Yes.
And you never introduce yourself, and I just go,
Waku! Waka!
And I like play a little drum. Uh-huh.
And that's Detective Pony.
It's a winning combo, I'll tell you that. Well, you're Michael.
Oh, okay.
We're exiting out of that other podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. So today, we're exiting out of whatever it was we were doing, and now we're doing this, which is talking about Detective Pony.
Don't sound so thrilled about it, Michael. Don't say, I can't believe it. The listeners are on the video chat, but I can see Michael. He's got his headset on. He's going around his room and just smashing shit with a hammer. He's so excited. He's throwing his bookcases on the floor. He's got some sort of artisanal tree identification chart. He's ripping that up with his bare hands and eating it. Mm-hmm. He's going hog wild. He's just got a very measured voice while he does it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's my whole deal. That's what I'm doing. I like Detective Pony, but it also means that we're going to have to talk about Derrida, which is not a thing that I particularly enjoy in and of itself. So,
well, I'll tell you this. I do like talking about Derrida, and I do like talking about Derrida by itself. I've spent a lot of time doing that. I, weirdly enough, lucky me. was first introduced to Derrida not through literary theory, which is where deconstruction probably has the greatest stranglehold.
So which Nine Inch Nails album referenced Derrida?
Well, I'll have you know it's an EP. No, it's not through that. I grew up knowing
Jacques Derrida personally.
Jacques Derrida personally. He's a little Frenchman. And I would go up to him and I'd say, Jacques Derrida. And he'd say, do not do that to me. Do not make fun of me like that. I am from Algeria. apologies to the French. It's funny to do. You can make fun of Americans. We give you permission. I know it's hard to get out there making fun of Americans, but we'll let you do it. When I was in college, I had the luck of working closely with someone, with a faculty member, who was an animal studies person.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked about him before. It was James Staniskew. I've talked about him many times on various programs. It comes up occasionally. He's an animal studies person. And this was right when Derrida's work on animals, particularly, I think, The Beast and the Sovereign, Volume 1, had just come out maybe around that time. But Derrida had written a bunch on animals and talked about animals occasionally and often used animals as his examples. And so he had a degree in a kind of continental philosophy program. And so he came to my college. And so that was my introduction to Derrida. So my introduction was not like grammatology. It was not structure, sign, and play, although I did go and read all of those things. And of course, I went to graduate school in moving image studies with a bunch of people who came up during the theory wars of the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Really, the theory wars were in the 80s, but they were kind of downstream from all of that. So I got just a heaping helping of Derrida all the time, but not the Derrida that I think most like English and literature studies people got, which is probably maybe closer to your realm. So I am much more familiar as well with familiar with the Derridas. I'm much more familiar with the Derrida of the animal that therefore I am, or the Derrida of the psyche like volumes the Spectres of Marx, the Gift of Death, So like the kind of ethical Derrida, I would, you know, there's kind of these waves of Derrida, the kind of different things he focused on. We can talk about that maybe later. But I'm a little bit more familiar with like the animals, the death penalty, the structure of money, the archive Derrida than I am with the early deconstruction of semiology Derrida, although I have that read that stuff. But I think that's going to make for a useful episode because we can kind of talk across what this thing is doing with Derrida, which I would say is 50% just inaccurate, which doesn't mean it's not fun, right? Yeah, like I actually do think this is quite fun, but I will say that you shouldn't read this and then just like go in and pretend that you like have Derrida on lock, because there's a strong misrepresentation of like structure sign and play or you know, the general mode of difference for that period of Derrida. I would say that those things are a little misrepresented, or maybe they are elided and honed in order to make them fit into a story structure. Maybe that's the thing. So, yeah, that's my beginning statement, my closing beginning argument about Derrida.
All right, yeah, you're correct that I think probably the first Derrida I read was of grammatology. So I come at it from the pure deconstructionist angle. I sort of get what Derrida is going after when I first encounter him, but I'm also like, why are you going after this? Like, what is at stake here? And eventually at some point in like later grad school, Derrida really clicks for me. And what is necessary for that is realizing that Derrida is in deep conversation with Bataille, who is someone that know better and also like, you know, like quite a bit. And so it was this one of those weird things where like no one had mentioned it in like 7 years of me having to deal with Derrida. And then I read it offhand in some note in some book that I was reading. And I was like, wait a minute, what the shit? And then I realized how you could slot those guys together. And I like suddenly got a handle on a lot more on like what Derrida's deal was and what he was trying to do.
I'm forgetting which volume it is. It might be Disseminations. I forget which volume that Structure, Sign, and Play is in, but whichever volume that is, whichever of the kind of collected Derrida things in that book is also, it's called like Introduction to the General Economy or On the General Economy, one of those. And that's his essay on Bataille. So, it, you know, and about how they're in conversation with one another. And so weirdly enough, yeah, that's the kind of, this is what has radicalized me into teaching full books in undergraduate education many times, because if you just read that essay, you'll never know what the other things that it was published with were and what the editors at the time and what Derrida kind of alongside them thought was important to put in conversation with one another. So you understood the arguments. Right, the Bataille is right there. Yeah, I would say in a general sense, right, if people are not familiar with Derrida, Algerian-born French philosopher, founds or develops the method of deconstruction, and it is largely in conversation with French theory, French and continental theory from the kind of 19th century and early 20th century. Derrida really becomes popular and prominent starting in the early 60s in France. But you know, is heavily in conversation with people like Bataille, but really, really heavily in conversation with Heidegger. And Heidegger is actually all over Detective Pony. I would say actually, weirdly enough, it is probably more of a Heideggerian project than it is a Derridean project, but we can talk about that when we talk about long Greek word definitions. But yeah, I mean, so Derrida is trying to figure out what is the project of philosophy in his time and place. And deconstruction becomes the kind of method to get at describing the project. So what are the underpinning concepts that make philosophy go? And are those underpinning projects or processes or ideas, are they the ones we know about, or are they ones that are kind of sublimated, hidden underneath that you have to perhaps deconstruct the project in order to figure out? And so a thing that's really critical that is maybe difficult to just kind of pick up Derrida and understand is that Derrida is a kind of metafictional, or not metafictional, but meta move on philosophy itself. Mm-hmm. Deconstruction is a thing you do to things in order to reveal stuff that might not be easily seen. You know, mm-hmm. You're getting at the bones of it. And so in the way that, like, Homestuck is a metafictional maneuver, a set of metafictional maneuvers that really end up revealing some suppositions about the way that fiction works, right? And that gives all these characters opportunities to talk about the way they think that fiction works. Deconstruction is this kind of method you use on other stuff to reveal how it works. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of not surprising to me that someone who is like reading Derrida or taking these kinds of philosophy or English courses might see a lot of connection between the two, because they are kind of after similar stuff, or they're certainly doing similar moves. If you've never seen Derrida, especially from this time, like the 60s in particular, you see a lot of split pages. You know, the text and formatting is quite weird. You'll see little boxes that are offset that are maybe footnotes. They're maybe part of the thing. You know, the new edition of Gloss, which has now been retitled to Klong, that's got like, I think German text on one, or maybe French text on one side and English text on the other. And there's just no, it's unclear if they're translations of one another or if they are the same. And it's actually being written on the text that he is referencing. So I don't have my Derrida shelf with me right now because I moved recently, but previously I did have all my Derrida within hand reach. But so all of the kind of things that Homestuck does, that we think about playing with typeset and formatting in the way that comics do, blah blah blah, Derrida in his writing was doing that with philosophy and the form and operation of philosophy, and trying to poke at the boundaries. And can you get out of philosophy? Can you do this kind of reflexive maneuver that gives you some ideas about what the implicit projects of what we might call biases or ideologies, although he doesn't use those terms, but you know, those are in the mix at the time in the 60s and 70s. Can you do that in the same way that Homestuck does that, right? Basically all of Derrida, if you just want to, I know I've been talking for a minute, Michael, I'm so sorry. this is my final thing to say about the big framing stuff, as far as I'm concerned on Derrida. Derrida is to continental, meaning European philosophy. Derrida is to continental philosophy in the mid 20th century as Cascade is to Homestuck in Homestuck times.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. That is an extremely silly but extremely accurate way of putting that.
It's like true. You see that frame expanding cascade, that's what Derrida does to philosophy.
Yes, right. It's like all of these things have just been running in parallel and no one had any idea how they were going to connect. And like Derrida shows up at where was it? Johns Hopkins in 68.
Yeah. Johns Hopkins, Stanford. There's like a bunch of different places. Yeah, that they end up going.
Yeah, so like he shows up and like all the things collide and like deconstruction falls out of that. So why in the hell are we talking about all this? You may be wondering if you're someone who has no idea what Detective Pony is,
And if you sat through 10 minutes of me just abstractly explaining Derrida.
Hmm. I mean, I think that's actually probably pretty apposite for what we're doing, because Detective Pony is a piece of fan fiction by a fan who went by the name of Sonnet Stuck on Tumblr. As I believe the Tumblr is still active. It's just sonnetstuck.tumblr.com, but also Detective Pony got its own separate Tumblr, and it's detective-pony.tumblr.com. It's also an archive of our own if you want to check it out there. But essentially, to back up just a little bit more, Sonnet Stuck, as the name implies, primarily wrote sonnets or poems about Homestuck things. Like, that was kind of Sonnet Stuck's whole deal, and that was, how I got introduced to them, him. I'm not entirely sure what preferred pronouns are here, just because there's not really that in the bio. But anyhow, this is how Sonnet Stuck comes to my attention initially, being on Tumblr and kind of in a Homestuck fandom adjacent spaces, like seeing these poems come through, and they're often modeled on the styles of poetry of other poets, right? Here's like a T.S. Eliot poem about Homestuck. Here is a William Blake poem about Homestuck, that sort of thing. And then Detective Pony takes the form of a long actual piece of fan fiction that is a realization of a brief joke from Homestuck itself. At the beginning of Act Six, when we're getting introduced to Jane, one of the things she has in her room is a copy of a teen, like a young reader series of books called Pony Pals. The specific book is called Detective Pony, and we find out that Dirk, who we don't know is named Dirk at that point, but, you know, whatever. Dirk sent it to her for her birthday. It is, it's been altered, like scribbled over, drawn on, and the whole thing is a reference to things Andrew Hussey has done that I've talked about on the main show, particularly the Wizardology book, which was something that Hussey like bought or acquired in some way, and then went through and altered, put in a bunch of jokes, like, you know, and I'm talking like far beyond like scribbling mustaches on all the pictures, right? But like drawing in extra little comics, altering language to make the sentences read differently and produce jokes that weren't there before. And this was given to a friend as a birthday present. And then it gets referenced in the way that Homestuck is constantly referencing Andrew Hussey's past work through this gift to Jane, where Dirk has gone through this young adult's book and done basically the same thing, like turning one character into an entire city, adding a cat that is, well, the cat is already there, but adding the detail that the cat is constantly shitting everywhere, that sort of thing.
Yep.
And it's like a two-page joke that we get in the main comic. And it is sort of not written off exactly, but, you know, gestured at like, oh, it gets like really intense. Eventually, like Dirk's text overtakes the entire original written text, and it becomes like this very difficult, emotionally difficult, but cathartic read. And that's what we know about it. So Sonnetstuck takes this sort of, you know, joke setup, and then basically just completes it. Like, what would this entire book look like if we got to see the whole thing? And as I said on the mainline episodes, at some point, like, it's truly an accomplishment because it's all of the pages have been edited. There's a whole lot of effort that's been put into this thing, and I not that I speculate, I know that Detective Pony is beloved in kind of Homestuck fandom circles. I talked about recently, even the Something Awful thread, which is like categorically opposed to fan fiction in the first instance, basically all the time, loves Detective Pony. And people have asked us, there are adaptations of this. I think one is maybe just audio, and then one is like audio and video. So people have like done adaptations of the story of Detective Pony. We're not going to be talking about them. I haven't watched them or anything. No shade to them specifically. It's just I've read Detective Pony and I kind of have my thoughts on that. And I don't know what I gain by kind of continuing down that rabbit hole. But maybe that's something we can look into in the future. Who knows?
Wow. I'm looking at the wow. Wow. I'm saying wow.
Mm-hmm.
What a fandom. Someone is doing, has done it with like little action figures with Barbie dolls and whatnot.
Yeah.
And horses.
Mm-hmm.
There's camera angles and shit.
Mm-hmm.
What in God's name? Well, I gotta listen. Hold on. I don't like the maneuver here. The maneuver, the decision they have made is where there is a traditional narrator, which mm-hmm. might be the like the audiobook for the book. And then when the Dirk text shows up,
mm-hmm.
They have like someone saying those lines.
Mm.
I don't care for that. They're also drawing the poop in because it's hard to get the poop everywhere.
That's great. Hand-drawn poop. That's not what you're not going to get that from the latest Marvel film.
You really won't. That's
they're going to green screen that shit in.
That's why Scorsese was right. It's not art. Look at Pawnee, though. This is a great adaptation of Pawnee. That's the most chaotic outfit I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, yes.
This is by Naked Bee, by the way, that I'm looking at. Naked Bee on,
yes.
On the old YouTube. I just Googled Detective Pawnee.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that people have asked if we're going to talk about. And that is a great outfit for Pawnee.
I mean, we're going to talk about it in that we just talked about it.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, the fact that something like Naked Bee's adaptation of Detective Pony exists is one of the things that makes me extremely fond of the Homestuck fandom, right? Like, that is, like, this is not an adaptation of something that happened in the comic. This is, like, a second-order fan adaptation, right? And in many ways, of course, like, Detective Pony itself, the fan fiction, I think sort of, you know, queries that kind of response because it is so much going in on this bit of being like a text written by Dirk. And this is how people, for instance, in the Something Awful thread understand it, right? That this is like, this is kind of the interpretive frame that you have to set up around it. You have to pretend that Dirk is, in fact, the author of this thing. You're not really thinking about Sonnet Stuck. You're looking at this thing as a piece of characterization for Dirk. And I think that's really interesting because I also think that the Dirk who is in this fan fiction is a very different Dirk from the Dirk who is in the actual comic. I don't know whether or not you agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. This is like some different other character. Like, it just has the name Dirk.
Yes. that is kind of my sense too, right? There's something, I mean, so what is this thing? Again, if you haven't read it, what is it? How does it work? What is it about? The original story of Detective Pony is about these four girls called the Pony Pals. That's the name of the series, right? And they're girls who love to take care of their ponies and ride them around. This is very much like pre-Harry Potter young adult fiction, you know, something like Sweet Valley High or The Babysitter's Club or things like that. The Animorphs actually is still kind of doing this model of 60 something books in a series that are all like 120 pages, maybe, if even that. That's like the ground floor setup, like who are these characters sort of initially, and the presentation that we get, like Dirk has gone in, he's changed one of the characters into the entire city of Pawnee, Indiana, from Parks and Recreation, which is a show that Jane likes. And there is a character, the main character of the Pony Pals, or at least this particular book, is named Anna. She has a horse named Acorn, and that's original to the text. But Dirk's text changes Acorn into this kind of like omnipotent god figure. Not even technically God, more like this like embodied force of chaos and destruction that exists inside the text and sort of exists orthogonal to the text, is sort of aware that he's like a character in a story and things like that. And he is confronted by a cat that is talking to him, not initially in the original story, like this is all added. And the cat lures Acorn into this like bizarre metaphysical judgment day wherein Acorn ends up meeting not only Jean Betancourt, the original author of the Pony Pals, but also Dirk is kind of the secondary author, is the person who's gone through and edited this. So like Dirk gets pulled into the story, and simultaneous to this, the Pony Pals are dealing with the absolute chaos that is their lives with events from the original story, such as an animal hospital catching on fire. But this is like agglomerated with things like one of them has an alcohol problem. There's a World War One soldier crawling around everywhere. This, that, and the other.
World War One soldier.
Yes, a German World War One soldier. I guess I forgot that part. So
his name's like Bethany or something.
His name is Brandy.
Brandy.
Because in the original story, he's a dog, like a golden retriever at the animal hospital. But then every time he's mentioned, it's marked out and he's made into this World War One Oberst Lieutenant.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like it's like, that joke is really funny to me.
Yes.
like extreme, but then it is matched, like, pound for pound, literally, by a cat that shits everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is like the most eye roll worthy garbage, right? Like, I just hate it. It makes me mad. I want to do my own version of Detective Pony where I cross that out.
Mm-hmm.
just to get rid of that stuff, because I think like the humor here is really funny, although it is extremely in the universe of both I don't know, internet comedy writing at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. there's a style here, like whatever the style after the greatest page in the universe is, right? Like the next one is that, and of which Homestuck is a part, right? So it's like kind of you know, doing a Homestuck riff, which makes sense, right? But you know, the humor feels borrowed in some places, but also kind of riffing on the broader humor writing culture at the time. So mm-hmm. I think sometimes it really hits and sometimes it is real bad.
Mm-hmm. I agreed. I think that's one of the benefits and drawbacks of a project this size and sort of this nature, is that there are so many opportunities to throw new jokes at the wall. That sometimes they really, really hit, and sometimes it is like, oh, okay, yeah, this is just a cat that shits everywhere. Notably, I think the cat shitting everywhere is one that Hussey comes up with, and then is like, because of that, it like carries through the rest of the entire text up until the point where, like maybe halfway through or maybe three quarters of the way through, they just like drop that joke and remark upon it, because it's like, well, I guess, like, you know, Dirk's influence over the narrative is lessening because I'm not shitting everywhere now. But that's the segue to the next part of the story. So we end up with kind of parallel narratives with Acorn and the cat, who ends up being named Minos, after the judge of the in the underworld in Dante's Inferno. Acorn and Minos and Dirk and Jean Betancourt are kind of having this conversation about like Acorn's sins, and can Acorn be redeemed, and what are the effects that Acorn has had upon this fictional world or what have you. And that sort of pivots into all of this questioning of Dirk, and like, what is Dirk doing in this story? Because Dirk is the one who's kind of introduced all these changes. Parallel to that, the original Pony Pals are like on this quest to find Acorn, and in the process slowly coming to understand that they themselves are fictional characters trapped within a story, and working up to a point where they are presented with an opportunity to like reset the text and expunge Dirk's presence and regain their former selves. And this gets weirdly metaphysical and off the wall in very Homestucky ways, ways that are clearly kind of like trying to be in dialogue with questions that I think Homestuck proper is raising. And this is also where a lot of the Derridian stuff comes in, where I will echo Cameron in here and saying that, like, I think there's a lot of fun stuff here, but also this is not a fault of the text, because I think like it's using Derrida to tell a story. So it's using sort of interpretations of Derridian ideas in order to make them kind of like plot devices, rather than like be a first order explication. Here is how Derrida works and here's how you should understand it kind of thing.
Right. Where'd this come from?
Which part?
the why did this person make this? Have you done any research on on why this exists?
Well, there was a Reddit AMA that Sonnetstuck did. I lost the link. I have too many tabs open. That's part of the problem here. Sonnetstuck a couple years ago did a Reddit AMA on the Homestuck subreddit. Gave the name as Bob. Again, I assuming he pronouns here, but I don't really know because they're not like signaled or flagged or anything like that. And people are obviously like, well, you know, what did you like? What was your process for this? How long did it take you to do this? And it kind of seems like, well, what Sonnetstuck says, what Bob says, is I first ordered my copy of the book a few months after the relevant pages of Homestuck came out. I edited the first chapter with post-it notes over the words Yeah, over the words over a few days. I slowly worked through the project over the next few months, a couple of pages at a time, without any real idea of where it was going. Around chapter 4, I ran out of ideas and set it aside for a while, and then eventually comes back to it. And so, I mean, it sounds like this was primarily, this was just like a kind of side project. I know that Sonnet Stuck, like the Tumblr blog, the Tumblog, as we used to say, mm-hmm. Often made reference to writing the poems as kind of like little ways to keep oneself busy while at work. I don't know exactly what the job was, but it seemed like it was a kind of desk job or some sort of like a service oriented job. So there were times when Sonnet Stuck was not interfacing with people and would just kind of like sketch out these ideas for poems and things. And that seems to be kind of the idea here, is that he was taken with the idea of filling out this entire book, you know, sort of seeing Dirk's project through to the end. And that's what happened.
Well, that's interesting. Of all the things to do with your free time, this.
An extended transcription or revision of Longfellow's translation of Dante's Inferno in the middle of your Homestuck fanfic about a horse and a constantly shitting cat going to the afterworld.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you want? I feel like this is a global discussion. Maybe we should talk about what's funny.
Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about like what's funny.
I don't like these little illustrations. They're not funny.
Those are all stolen from Andrew Hussey's previous illustrations in Wizardology and elsewhere, I believe.
Wow, damn. All of them are?
Maybe some of them are bespoke. But Sonnet Stuck gives a credits page on the Tumblr and explains where basically everything came from. Even like all of the citations, like the quotations and allusions that happen are all listed on the credits page.
I like the footlong ad or the Subway footlong ad that's in the middle.
Yes. And this is a reference to the Sweet Brew and Hella Jeff book that got published through Topedo Co. That was designed by, Hussey, I think Casey Green, I think Drill had a hand in that, and maybe a couple of other people. But part of the joke of the Sweet Bro and Hella Jeff book is that it was the Sweet Bro and Hella Jeff comics, but like published in this massive, like expensive hardcover. And it had like seven different, you know, those books that have like ribbon place markers stitched into the binding.
Mm-hmm.
It had like seven of them, and some were on the top and some were on the bottom. The page numbers were all wrong. There was a plastic spoon that was taped to one of the pages. And then there was like a whole page that was just like Subway coupons. Like the idea was they applied the logistics of Sweet Bro and Hella Jeff to the production, the physical production of a book, right?
Right.
Because Sweet
Bro. So what if you made a book suck on purpose?
Yes, right. Like what if you made the worst book possible as a physical object? It also had a nacho cheese scent. That
the book?
Yeah, the book had like nacho cheese scented pages.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It's still available. And Topatico says plenty in stock.
I have heard, unfortunately, that the nacho cheese scent has faded. Didn't last forever.
You really undersold this spoon thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's carved out of the back of the book as if it's like a gun would go there or a knife. Oh,
okay. Yes, that was it. I think wild. It also came with like a bottle of hot sauce.
Cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's again, so many sort of references to like other Homestuck properties. There's this like whole mimetic thing going on. So, yes, I like. Well, we already talked about Brandy, the German World War One soldier.
Mm-hmm.
I like. Who is it that gets like a mother who's cosplaying as Mikhail Gorbachev constantly? I think that's Pam.
Yep. Mikhail Gorbachev is in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
As represented.
as represent.
Yeah. There's the one of their dads who is the veterinarian. Yes. Who eventually gets murdered slash murders at the same time. It's very much a it is funny how the Homestuck like cut to a fight happens here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very much a move in where we would see those things happen in Homestuck, but here it's just written. And like they shoot each other in the chest while a chandelier falls on them. That's how like Brandy and someone's dad die.
Yes.
It's pretty wild.
And that's during a point where the narrative has become self-aware and has decided that it's going to stop paying attention to the story that's being told.
Yes. And it has to be like brought back over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some just like very funny, like literature-y jokes, you know, like after a while, Pam barbarically yawped. I yes. see some bullshit over here to advance the plot.
Yes. Yeah. One of the other like one of the really small jokes that I really like is very often what will happen is the dialogue tag someone said, the said will always be like marked out and replaced with like a more specific and less appropriate word.
Mm-hmm. what is this infection of Parks and Recreation?
Well, I think that's one of the things that I think many people understand is like this being an in-universe text, quote unquote, right? This is a book that you are supposed to read like the books that you pick up in Morrowind, right?
But so I guess that's before you answer that question, let me ask you another clarifying question. So the way that this is engaged with by the fandom mm-hmm. is as if it is a continuation of that book that we saw a couple pages of.
Yes.
So it's treated as like so like this for some subset of people is like, oh, yeah, this is really fanfic about Dirk.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that. Yes, absolutely.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
So what if Dirk doesn't sound in the comic anything like this Dirk? What if they are unrecognizable to one another?
Well, then you just imagine them as the same thing and it works out.
I refuse to do that. That's why I don't like fanfic. I can't imagine. I can speculate, but I can't imagine.
This is to the point that I think we're constantly making on the main show, right? Is that you can kind of like work different representations of like you can take two representations and say they're the same character, and you can kind of like do the mental math to make that legislate out. Like you can do that, and like you're doing it all the time. And when people take this vision of Dirk as like somehow textual or really informative to their understanding of Dirk in the actual story, that's a thing that you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a broken record on this. You can make anything anything. Mm-hmm. You can make anything say anything you want. You mm-hmm. can make anything do anything you want. You can take any given points of information and string them together on a daisy chain of perfect pearls that create some sort of coherence in the world, right? Like this is a uniquely, contemporary human form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, perhaps not uniquely, but it is a contemporary human form. We like to do this. Mm-hmm. That it is a vast amount of our media experience. It's a vast amount of our political experience
mm-hmm.
in the world. And so I guess, you know, the thing to me is like, all right, well, what are like the outcomes of that? It's been really interesting to see in the Discord, someone recently joined. I don't have to read their name, but someone recently joined and was kind of talking about their fandom impulse that they had, right, when they mm-hmm. were a big part of the Homestuck fandom. And for them, you know, they're being very explicit in the chat of being like, okay, yeah, you know, what is interesting is that y'all are pointing out all these things in the show about kind of big schematic or thematic things that are happening. But I didn't care about that because I only really cared about like characters and their qualities and how they kind of exploded out from their little kernel, you know, of what they are initially.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is just kind of like set dressing to push that characterization along, you know, mm-hmm. essentially is what they're saying. So it's a light summary. They give a much more thorough kind of discussion than that. And so for me, that's really interesting, right? Because it requires you, you know, I know this is an episode about Derrida, but to bring a little Jean-Francois Lyotard over here, right? Like, it requires you to exercise judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a judgment that is not foregrounded, right? It's a judgment that people would not say, hey, you need to think about your process of judgment. But judgment is kind of legislating among different paradigms for Lyotard, right? How do you make a decision about how to interpret a certain bit of information within a framework? Mm-hmm. And he really cared about it in a big political sense, right? Leotard cared because he was watching in the 1950s and 1960s, he was watching neo-Nazis on the rise in France and Holocaust deniers in France. And so for him, it mattered a lot that they could look at the same world that he looked at and come to radically different conclusions. And if that were possible, if they could take the same evidence about mass death, horror, the, you know, some of the worst things that have been done to human beings in the 20th century, if they could do that and come to different conclusions about the facts of the world than he did with all the same information, then what did that mean? Like, mm-hmm. what was happening? And so for him, he kind of came up with this or developed this whole kind of series of thoughts about the way that judgment operated and the way that we evaluate information in front of us and what was happening in the transformation going into the 60s. He eventually writes a text called The Postmodern Condition, which is him working through what has changed in the world so that these things could happen and become much more omnipresent than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the quote unquote fake news phenomenon, right, which if we remember accurately, actually began with kind of National Democrats saying that, mm-hmm. Around the 2016 elections. That phenomenon, how do you have parallel facts or alternate facts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Leotard was writing about the question of alternate facts in the 1960s and basically spent his whole career writing about it. Okay, anyway, but so to take it all the way back, obviously how you characterize people in fandoms is not the same level of big distinction, right? Or like political necessity, mm-hmm. as whether or not they're Holocaust deniers. That's not what I'm saying. But Leotard made this system to talk to this really politically charged example that he really cared about. But he, through the rest of his career, went on to talk about how it's happening in lots of different spaces. And if there's a transformation in modernity that produces postmodernity, it is this transformation in judgment. And so his way of getting at it, so his solution, right, not a way to fix it, but a way of actually addressing the problem head on, would be to front load the way that we talk about judgment. Mm-hmm. So not simply just to make decisions within discourse groups, within the people you talk about and not really think about that. It's to be meta reflective. How are we making choices? How are we making decisions? What are the choices and concerns and decisions that are happening? And can you put two forms of judgment in contest with one another?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? How do you put a one way of evaluating the world up against another method and determine what one gets you and what one doesn't? So, I think probably if you're listening to Range Touch programs in a broad sense, you're hearing me and a lot of other episodes right now, right? Uh-huh. Leotard is running, and it's a background process all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's taking up a huge amount of RAM. It's really a problem. It's like leaving Chrome tabs open.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting to me, the reason I bring all of this up and give this little history here, and Leotard and Derrida are contemporaries, of course. The reason I kind of bring this up is this is kind of how I think about the fandom impulse that we're talking about here, right? Is that when the thing that you're discussing here about making choices about how do you make a characterization compatible with your like mental model of a character, right? Like that to me is just an implicit form of judgment, mm-hmm. right? Like the fandom discursively by talking to one another is making explicit and implicit choices about what gets to count, what gets to fit in, what gets to be part of the agreed upon discursive formation. And they are making other decisions about what doesn't. The society is predicated on something. I forget the phrase. But they're doing that. But what seems fascinating to me, the thing that I've kind of gotten from being in contact now with so many previous and now still current Homestuck fans, most of whom have been delightful. It's been really interesting to get involved in this fandom and I guess be part of the fandom now, at least lightly. What's been so fascinating is that there seems to be really no discussion about that, mm-hmm. In terms of how are we making choices about what fits and what doesn't. There's lots of debate about what fits, but not about the process of kind of induction into that. And maybe there is, and just no one's ever talked to me about it before. And certainly I've never brought it up. So maybe this is just like a, since this is the Derrida episode, an aporia here that has been produced by our discursive formations. But that's why I've really been thinking about is that, there is this process. And to put this in conversation with what you were just saying, I'm again, sorry to monologue about it. You just get me so excited, Michael, about mm-hmm. talking about Detective Pony. The thing that I think about here is whatever discussion about judgment that could happen here, how do we make things fit? How do we talk to one another? How do we come upon an agreed kind of meta world, you know, for the text in which certain interpretations in fan fiction of the characters are more important or have more weight or get talked about more kindly than others, or some are ignored. The where that might happen seems to have been eaten, right? It seems to have been kind of displaced, pushed off by Hussey's explicit form of fiction making. Their like mm-hmm. theory of fiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the, like, there is a platonic form of this character. There are certain shared characteristics, and through all of the different interpretations, you can get to the one shared set of characteristics, and that is Dirk or whatever, right?
Right.
You know, that's kind of the hive mind will create the overlap that is uniquely in, you know, that is in common with all else. And that common denominator of character is the character.
Yes.
And so it seems to me that for a lot of these discussions, the ones I've read on Tumblr, things I've been linked, discussions I've seen had, things like that, that where there might have been more robust conversation within the Homestuck fandom about what counts and what doesn't count. And I've like looked at the Reddit before and things like that when these things come up, where that might have occurred was displaced by kind of an authorial set of statements that were so friendly and so kind and so opening to a fandom that it's easier to go with that, or more compelling, not easier, more compelling to go with that as a fandom than to really kind of think about the judgment function that's happening all the time.
Yeah, I think that that's about right. And I also think the other side of the coin here is that I think there are like discussions, sort of meta discussions happening about fandom judgments, I think, but mm-hmm. they're often taking the form of, how do I put this? Like, what's a good way to like condense this down? It's a very like social media post, say like 2012, 2013 format of discourse, where things like, you know, I've noticed people who, and this is like this, the thing that I'm about to say is purely like a example that I'm constructing in my mind at this moment. But at the same time, I know for a fact that these discussions were had at some point by some people because of the vastness of this thing and kind of how fandom works. So if you are hearing echoes of things that you experienced, I'm not trying to talk to or at or around you. I'm just like throwing mm-hmm. together an ad hoc here.
You're literally making a thing up, uh-huh. but because the vastness of human experience is such, the thing you made up exists somewhere.
Right.
Oh, got it.
So okay. People saying things like, if you ship Dirk and Jane, you are being homophobic because you are erasing Dirk's queerness.
Right.
Right. It'll boil down to kind of these questions of like, what do these characters represent in a straightforward, maybe identity based way of thinking? You know, they're obviously good reasons for this, like, you know, people being harassed for drawing art that shows the kids as non-white, and Hussey has to step in and like be very firm about the whole a-racial thing. So
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that this is like lesser or to denigrate that, but it's like, where is that judgment that you're talking about being made explicit? It's happening in those moments where people are thinking through like the consequences of particular headcanonings or the assignations of particular behaviors to characters, right?
Yeah. And the Leotardian move. So just to use the example to kind of, you know, talk about the thing that I just talked about, right? Like within that, as you're saying, right, that's a useful setup for like discussions internal to the discourse, right? Like what parts of character identities are important, mm-hmm. right? But like the Leotardian move, just to kind of clarify, the question of judgment would be to take one step back from that
mm-hmm.
and then ask the question, why is it that fan fiction around character identity is the sole determinant, right? Are there opportunities for thinking of these characters as like polycultural, right? That they have lots of different kind of formations, or is there just one interpretation of them that needs to be combated out, right? And those are two separate paradigms of engaging with the text, right? One, which is that all things might count in some form or fashion, and that, you know, you can have an ethic of protecting that. And then on the other side, it's no, we need to debate it out. There are particular kinds of things that are perceived to be a priori, so in the first instance, harmful, and they need to be excluded before we can even talk about the characterization, right? Like, those are two completely different ways of engaging with the text, right? And to do this kind of Leotardian critique of judgment, or thinking through the question of judgment, we would want to step out and have that discussion, right? But it seems like the fandom is not interested in having that discussion for I mean, obvious reasons. Like, meta-discursivity is not fun, you know, inherently by itself. Although Homestuck tries, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, this results in a situation where, for instance, and people in the Something Awful thread said this, right? They read Detective Pony and they're like, man, this is my preferred version of Dirk. And so this means that they flatten out what I think are some of the big differences between Dirk and Detective Pony and, like, Dirk in the comic, one of which is, like, Dirk in the comic is not this well read or this deeply elusive at all. Like, just fundamentally, and I say this, like, we're talking about things that we enjoy and things that we like, it should be underscored that Detective Pony is made for me in like an Amigara Fault kind of way, right? Like, the bits where, like, characters just, like, out of nowhere quote Andrew Marvell, and I'm like, oh, that's an Andrew Marvell quote. Like, that's me, right? That's for me. That's when the thing on the screen does the good thing and I get to clap for it.
Yeah, I've read a big part of your novel. I know. I get it.
Yeah.
That's a thing that I got too caught up doing my bit at the beginning, because mm-hmm. I intended to begin this episode by saying, wow, we both really dodged a bullet on writing this thing, didn't we?
That is, yes. Like,
there's a slightly one universe over version where we both wrote this.
Yes.
Just in radically different ways.
Yes. I think actually, like, months ago, like, yeah, maybe even a year ago, before I was even sure that we were going to do this for a bonus episode, I sent you Detective Pony just so you could see it. And you were like, did you write this? Like, is this secretly yours?
Can I be honest? So I was reading it over the past couple of days, and about halfway through, I was sitting here and I was like, I wonder if Michael wrote this. I was like, what if Michael is just tricking me? And his big plan is to reveal in this episode that he did write this. Because there are just so many turns here that are so, like, distinctly you, but you when you were, like, 20 years old. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like there's such a youthful, overriding, there's something going on here. And honestly, that's actually when I Googled Sonic Stuck and their other projects to be like, who is this person? And then I found another thing that they worked on, which I think you would never do. So I was like, shoo, it's definitely not Michael. Mm-hmm. But yes, I did think yet again, what if Michael did this?
So yeah, like, yeah, you are exactly right. There is a point of time in, like, my early 20s where I was in love with, like, the form of the illusion, ALLUSION, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That type of illusion. And this is something that still has a big determining effect on the way that I intersect and like, analyze texts. You know, you can listen to Just King Things, and I'm constantly being like, well, here's a thing that Steve is doing that's either, like, him directly cribbing from or, like, echoing or stumbling into the same kind of plot device as author X, Y, and Z in whatever book. And I still believe this. This is I recently had my class day with my students where I was giving this spiel where I think what is the most interesting way of engaging with literature, which doesn't mean it's, like, interesting for everyone. Right. I'm not making a universal judgment here. But the thing that I do, the thing that is interesting to me is precisely looking at texts in relationships with one another and seeing how they speak to one another and what kinds of thoughts are individual texts trying to get at. And then when we put those two texts together, how does that change the thoughts that we arrive at, or how does that open various possibilities, so on and so forth. in my early 20s, I was more of a like, oh man, if I quote, God, I don't know, Proust here, people are going to think I am so clever. And also with a little bit of irony, right? Because people will know that I think that I'm a guy who's quoting Proust to be clever, which is exactly right. What Detective Pony is doing with Dirk. Like, he's a guy who self-consciously quotes with like an ironic distance.
Right. 100%.
Right.
But which turns him into like a type of guy, right? Like he, it, and interestingly to me, like, this is not the type of guy who exists in the Homestuck comic.
Yeah.
He is the type of guy, but he's Batman, as I have asserted previously.
I'm going to have so much more to say about that on the main episodes, by the way. Like, little preview here is like Cameron saying that in whatever partisode really unlocked an aspect of Dirk for me that didn't quite make sense. And now I cannot unhear his dialogue in like Batman terms.
He's like a 15-year-old kid who talks like this.
Mm-hmm.
I am the knight. Oh, speaking of the guy, he passed away. R.I.P.
What?
Batman.
Batman passed? Kevin Conroy. Yeah. Okay, yes.
Yeah, Kevin Conroy. I just couldn't come up with the name. Yeah, R.I.P. You know, it's not often that we got to take a pause out in the middle of an episode, especially not a bonus-ode, to say R.I.P., but R.I.P. to Kevin Conroy. He seemed cool.
Mm-hmm. He did.
Seemed like a nice guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, R.I.P. I watched so much Batman the Animated Series.
I was watching Batman the Animated Series the other day.
It's good.
Watching fucking Man-Bat flying around.
It's real good.
It's great. It's good stuff.
But anyway, back to the text. Mm-hmm. So one of these kind of judgment things that's going on is, yeah, people taking this kind of well-read, very deeply elusive Dirk and then sort of connecting that to Dirk in the comic. But then the other thing that happens is, like, for instance, one of the Pony Pals, again, I think it's Pam. One of the recurring jokes about her is that she has an alcohol problem. So there's always just these constant inserted lines of how, like, Pam pulled out her flask and took a big glug or whatever. She's downing gin. And then in a, again, a very Homestucky kind of way, the way that it repeats jokes and repeats punchlines. It's always like she took a drink. She really had a serious problem. And that's just repeated again and again and again. And so people read that and they're like, oh, this is Dirk trying to work through stuff with Roxy, who in the comic has a drinking problem, but no one is really talking about it or acknowledging it. So this is him like maybe keying into that and also keying into the fact that like no one's talking about it, and then reprocessing it as a joke in the text for his friend, for example.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that makes sense.
Right. And this has like a rubber band effect, right? This allows you to then speculate on, in your reading here, is this Dirk like being sympathetic but unsure of how to like broach this issue, or is it Dirk being cold and kind of uncaring about the issue? Right. Like this is kind of, I think, how the daisy chain works out in like what does engaging with fan fiction in this way do for you? What are the doors that it opens? And it's kind of like just a scaffolding for additional like speculation and interpretation along the lines of the stuff that's happening in the comic, but about stuff that the comic doesn't really dig into that much.
Mm-hmm. Like Plato's Pharmacon.
Yes.
Plato's Pharmacy.
Okay. Well, I guess that's it. We don't have to talk about anything else. We definitely don't have to talk about chapter 3 when Dirk has his first big thing where he talks about memes.
Oh, Lord. And mimesis?
And mimesis.
And the semiotic chain?
Uh-huh.
You ever seen a fictional teenager from the, it's not the oddies, what, the teens, the 20-teens? Mm-hmm. What are they called? Fictional teenager from the 20-teens talk about 1960s references to 1940s semiotic analysis. You ever see that happen?
I think I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. Who wore it better, Hideo Kojima or Dirk from Homestuck?
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah, so in chapter 3, like, Dirk kind of commandeers the narrative. Like, he eventually commandeers the entire narrative, like, from about the midpoint on. And so,
wait, his name's Dirk?
Yeah.
I thought his name was Dink this whole time.
hello, Douglas. So, yeah, like Dirk goes long on this like theory of platonic objects in memes, saying that what changed memes fundamentally was in 2006, 2007, when I Can Has Cheeseburger made memes mainstream. And the original sin of meme culture was adding text to images.
I got a little thing to read you.
Okay.
Let me do this for you. Hold on. I got to pull up a good example. Here we go.
Okay.
Your shaving brush has had its day, so why not shave the modern way with Burma Shave?
Sounds a little bit like you're reading copy from an advertisement.
A shave that's real, no cuts to heal. A soothing velvet afterfeel. Burma Shave.
Burma Shave.
Burma Shave. These are the Burma Shave ads, which weirdly enough will come up at in Just King Things at some point soon. Uh-huh. But if they haven't already, I can't remember. But they were road sign ads that were single little pieces of little rhyming couplets, poetry, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they were ads. And so you would read them and they would be what? Like just a little while in between them, you know, so it'd be like cheer up face. And then you drive a little bit and the war is past. Drive a little bit. The H is out. Drive a little bit of shave. Drive a little bit. At last. Drive a little bit. Burma Shave.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So these things they are a primordial meme.
Mm hmm.
Right, because like the notion and slapping Burma Shave onto like some little goofy thing you said is like the coolest thing you can do in a magazine in 1940.
Yes.
Like it's the white, because these start in the 20s and are really popular in the 30s, 40s, 50s. They kind of keep going.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time. And yeah, they're they are this like meme form that mm-hmm. that proliferates everywhere that is explicitly about like the chain of signification. You got to like hold it in your head and you got to know that Burma Shave as like this punchline anchors the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not, look, like Dirk in Detective Pony is not mounting a serious argument about the universe.
Mm-mm.
You know, so we always at risk on Homestuck Made This World of taking the joke too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I'm taking the joke too seriously. I'm doing it right now.
Mm-hmm.
There is no like to disabuse people of the notion. The meme is language before it is visual content.
Mm-hmm.
And the likening of the visual with the kind of platonic, the numinous, whatever. And the language as like the fallen chain, you know, somewhere along it gets turned into language. That's like not what's up. In fact, they were all the same to begin with.
Yeah.
The image meme and the language meme, which is kind of what he gets to at the end. But I just need to make that very clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Listen to Game Study Study Buddies this month when we're talking about Shuvik Mukherjee's what the heck is the title of that? Video Games and Storytelling. And we're going to talk actually probably quite a bit about how he uses Derrida and this idea of the originary that I think maybe will clarify some of this. But yeah, you're right. Like this is not a serious Derridian argument. Nevertheless, on the main episodes, I had to point out when the fictional teenage girl misused psychoanalytic terminology, and I'm going to record a bonus episode on the fictional teenage boy misusing deconstructionism. So
because we won't allow it. We're not going to let these fictional teens keep getting away with it.
No, it's happened for too long.
It's happened for the fictional teens have gotten to Ferris Bueller got to have a whole fucking day off, and we have never recovered. We're in there. We're Ben Stein.
Uh-huh.
Although we don't believe the things that Ben Stein believes.
Mm-mm.
But structurally, we're the Ben Stein. We say Bueller, Bueller, Bueller. Ferris Bueller. Bueller. And we are clowned upon for it.
Mm-hmm. But we're just trying to do our jobs as educators.
We're just trying to do our jobs, you know. We're trying to give away all this money we have.
Mm-hmm.
We're on a game show. You got to beat us.
Yeah, so that's Dirk's first big thing, is like trying to work out this idea that language got added to memes, and this was somehow like a big cultural shift that was disastrous or perhaps negative, when in fact, as you've said, Cameron, like one of the points of Derridian sort of philosophy here is that visuality was like reproducible. Visuality was already a language too. Like the writing is not in fact the like written language is not in fact the fall from grace that we think it is, because the entirety of Plato's Pharmacy, Derrida's essay where he works through this extensively, is showing how Plato like undergirds his whole project by saying that like writing is a fallen form of speech, that speech is more living, it's basically closer to the originary point of things than writing is like second order removed, and what Derrida does through the method of deconstruction is just like pop that inside out to show that like actually spoken language is itself like contingent and arbitrary and finite in the same ways that writing is as well.
Yeah, when I was in undergrad, I ended up taking a course in literary stuff that where deconstruction was like a day or something, right? Mm-hmm. Which you know you're going to get a good survey when like an important piece of maximal literary theory is reduced to about an hour and 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Give or take. I don't know. We're taking attendance. You might be down to like 110. But I will never forget, because it was such a thing I don't agree with. The professor said, deconstruction is about taking one thread, from the sweater that is the novel or the essay or the argument, and pulling on the one thread until the whole thing unravels. And there's nothing further from what deconstruction does than to do that. If we were going to analogize deconstruction to some sort of sweater-based thing, mm-hmm. right? It's that someone would be wearing the sweater, and then you use deconstruction to find out the person wearing the sweater is not there at all. They're somewhere else. They're across the planet. Mm-hmm. And there's just a big hollow sweater here that is supported entirely by the idea that the person's inside that sweater. But really, they're in Bermuda hanging out. They're mm-hmm. on the beach. Mm-hmm. They're rolling around in the sand. They're getting dirty.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're in toxic waste swimming around. And the sweater is here moving around, being puppeted by nothing other than the belief that the person is there. Right. Because the animating concerns of deconstruction is that there are structures that are afforded from other positions in the kind of broad social or philosophical world that we live in that have effects, like uncanny effects, everywhere else. And in fact, the work of replication, of making things in the world, that work is taking on hidden values and notions and concepts that end up not being present while still structuring the entirety of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I do think that Dirk kind of gets us. It's so deep in this one chapter of what is Plato's Pharmacy? Is it in Disseminations? I can't remember. Let me look. Look here. Plato's Pharmacy.
Come by and get some cough drops.
Where is it?
I'm double checking.
I wish my Derrida is still packed, otherwise I could go get it.
Yeah. I should look this up too. It might be in Disseminations.
It's like a sub book, but it's in another book. Where is Plato's Pharmacy published?
People are just like talking about no, it's the review.
Leave it all in where we gotta figure it out.
Yeah.
It's in Dissemination.
Dissemination, yeah. Okay.
It is in 1972's Dissemination. Mm-hmm. So the unfortunate part of Dirk being so, and therefore Sonnetstock also, I think in this case, being so deep in Plato's Pharmacy is that I think there's a little bit of missing the forest for the trees, right? Like Plato's Pharmacy as a like short book slash long essay stands in for all this other stuff. It stands in for deconstruction. It stands in for difference, the trace, all this kind of stuff. When they are speaking to the same thing, but they are not the same thing. You know, the trace is not what's happening in the essay, or defining the trace, I don't think, is what's happening in Plato's Pharmacy essay. Plato's Pharmacy essay, by the way, is if you want to read someone doing basically, like we said before, fanfic on the 20th century philosophical tradition, you can go do that. Like the piece at the end where it's like talking about the cutout from the Derrida at the end of this of Detective Pony.
Oh yeah,
where. Mm-hmm. Where it's like Plato closing up the pharmacy, that is the kind of stuff that's in that.
Right.
So it is quite fun to read.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so, oh, sorry, to follow up with what you were saying. Yeah, the point of this is not that, as you said, right, you know, that speech is more true or good or whatever, you know, the capital G good, and therefore language is fallen. I mean, Dirk does get here in the across the whole thing, right?
Right.
But the point is to say that one cannot have speech without the defining operations of written language, and one cannot have written language without the defining operations of speech, that they mutually constitute one another. And more importantly, you can't understand the distinction between the two without the other one existing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of what deconstruction gets used to do is to deconstruct dichotomies,
mm-hmm.
right? So good, evil, the civilized, the uncivilized, the colonial and the post-colonial, right? You know, Gayatri Spivak is a huge kind of deconstructive figure who's still around. And Spivak continues to use deconstruction as a way of thinking through, well, what is the colonial relation? You know, how does the post-colonial subject constitute the colonizer, meaning that the colonizer can only understand themselves by the abuse, destruction, the educational deformation, right, of who they're colonizing. They do that operation as a way of defining themselves mm-hmm. in that space. And then the colonial subject understands themselves in excess of that, right, and ways of maneuvering around it. The deconstruction was very, very popular among post-colonial scholars, particularly in the 90s, precisely for this kind of baseline reason. If you want to look at systems where there are mutually defining characteristics, deconstruction is really helpful for that. It's a really helpful method for getting underneath it, and kind of getting at what the levers are and what the, you know, kind of big red, conspiracy board strings are between, different elements within a social system that seem, very easily Manichaeanly split off from one another. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, they often mutually constitute one another, and language and orality, right. Written language begins to define an orality and the rules of oral speech in the same way that oral speech is kind of immediacy, or its ability to speak to, attack, whatever, ends up defining what gets written. So when Derrida writes about the law in the way the law happens, right? When things happen under the eye of the law that are verbal, they operate differently than the way they happen when they are spoken, right? But the oral argument in the courtroom and the written decision, right, have a mutually constituting reality with one another. So, I mean, you know, the guy wrote like, I don't know what, 40 books or something like that.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, all doing the same thing. I mean, the method is relatively stable across most of his career. And so he applies this to everything. But really, how do things mutually constitute? How is the stability that we thought we had, how does it exist maybe on nothing other than its own kind of presupposition? Mm-hmm. And where are there absences where we thought there were you know, productions or pieces?
Right.
That's what deconstruction gets you.
Right. To pull this into like the famous example of the pharmacon itself, just to give it some like grounding.
Yeah.
The ancient Greek word pharmakon notably could mean both poison and cure. And therefore, when you're translating from Greek to another language, let's say English, what you're translating, like when you hit the word pharmakon, whether or not you're translating that as poison or cure, let's say, depends on the context that you can glean from everything around it. And one of the things to take away from this, this idea that in, you know, ancient Greek, like pharmakon is going to mean both of these things. Well, one of the ways that the detective pony takes it is that this is a problem that is unique to English, that English makes a distinction here where Greek does not. And when you are reading a translation, you are like looking over, you're looking over, literally overlooking the process by which that translation needs to happen. And you're not getting kind of the resonances of the original Greek, where that is going to be much more ambiguous. The other way of looking at this is that pharmakon means both poison and cure, because in ancient medicine, they were. Like, you take too much of a medicine, you die right. of poisoning, right? You eat something that's bad, that's poisonous. You take a little bit of medicine, another type of poison that makes you throw things up, right?
Yeah. Think about chemotherapy.
Yes, right? Exactly. Right. So the point here is that like the binary logic of, you know, poison and remedy implies a world where there are good things that are remedies for us, and then there are bad things that are poisonous to us. But in fact, on a basic fundamental level, they are different applications of the same thing. That there is no presence that is wholly beneficial and no presence that is wholly like harmful. That there is just this thing that has applications in various cases.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the perfect example. And so that, you know, that is the interesting part, I think, about, and the reason why at the beginning of this episode I was like, you know, you can't take this the Sonic Stuck to Dirk interpretation of Derrida too seriously or too far, I guess is what I mean, or too explanatory, is because I think that the Dirkification misses some of that just baseline stuff. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose. The purpose is that it's the cure that kills. Mm-hmm. And the cure that kills in and of itself demonstrates this kind of deferring method that maneuvers there. Mm-hmm. So
right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think like it's one of those things where thematically, I think that in my version of this fan fiction, right, with my different understanding of Derrida, the ending of this thing looks so much different, because the ending of the story of Detective Pony pivots so much on this idea of like restoring the text that Dirk has ruined, a kind of expiation or a sort of like cleansing, that I think, you know, deconstruction as a method is not really into, right? This idea that you could like separate out the bad parts or like restore a thing. Is kind of counter to the point that deconstruction is always going to make, which is that like you trace this thing back to its origin and it turns out the contagion is already there in the first instance.
Yeah, that's always I'm not going to get into it, but the key term here, right, is, you know, based on what you just said a minute ago, right, it's the deconstruction's critique of the metaphysics of presence. Mm-hmm. And the metaphysics of meaning as presence, right? So the derivement of information or meaning, just in a broad sense, in the broadest possible sense of that term. So like content, but also like significance, with the idea that things are there and things are kind of immediate to hand, as opposed to an absence, right? An absence of direct meaning, or an absence of, and also, I guess, ambiguity as an absence. Mm-hmm. Right? That perhaps a benefit could be, if there's an ethics to deconstruction, which I think there is, if there's an ethics to deconstruction, it's developing a sense of that, right? A sense of an okayness with the absence, a sense of an okayness with the ambiguity, and a structure of ambiguity, right? Mm-hmm. That you know, the cure that kills is sometimes beneficial and sometimes it's the thing that kills you. And that's the reality of, you know, intervening in the biological human. Mm-hmm. There's not a good or a bad,
right?
There is a process, and it produces different things, which doesn't mean that within that reality, you don't then create ethical structures, right? Like, this is not like it's not like a call, you know, to be like, well, everyone's got a perspective on the world and you just got to respect it. You know, that's not the maneuver here, right? But the maneuver is to say that like there are deep ambiguities within the core and manufactured to ambiguities, right? Like in the post-colonial situation that I was referencing before, where deconstruction is really prominent as a way of engaging with that, right? There, you know, Spivak is not doing deconstruction to then be like, well, we don't know who's good or bad in this situation. Colonizer or colonized, who knows, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's not the point. The point is to point out that the structure itself is so dependent on mutual constructions and ambiguities and absences and assertions of particular modes of being that were never really there to begin with. It's so full of that, the deconstruction allows you to kind of pull all those out into a linearization. You can understand how they function. And then within that, you make an ethic, right? Mm-hmm. Like you make an assumption to universally support the colonized. Deconstruction has an ethics that you can derive from it. Deconstruction is a method. Deconstruction is ultimately not an outcome, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's a thing you apply to other stuff to get something else. Mm-hmm. It's a chemical reaction. It is not gold. Mm-hmm. And that's critically important here too.
Yeah.
Especially in the thing that uses it as like the gold at the end of the rainbow, right? Mm-hmm. Like at the end of Detective Pony, what you get is like, what isn't Derrida interesting, right? Like the product is this kind of massive data dump of information where we're like learning about memes or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. That's not for deconstruction. The end goal is not to be like, hey, I did it. The end goal is to do some other thing with the knowledge that you have derived from the method.
Yeah. I think I want us next to get into Anna, the character who like dies and comes back to life and then like has all of the other texts inside of her, because I want to think through mm-hmm. that. But I think the one sure. other thing to mention here on deconstruction that I've wanted to mention it since the beginning and keep forgetting. This is being written and read at a point in internet, like pop culture, fandom spheres or spaces or whatever, that I remember being absolutely lousy with the term deconstruction. I don't mean lousy as in like bad. I mean lousy in the sense as in like covered in lice. Although I guess that is bad, but
which is not bad. Yeah. 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 We would never, never start that would be bad. Yeah.
But I just mean like, I don't know if this was your experience, Cameron, but I feel like in like the early 2000s or not the early 2000s, but kind of the early 2010s, we got a whole slew of, people saying that they were going to like do deconstruction. Like we're doing pop culture deconstruction, and what they really mean is close reading.
I don't know. I can't speak to that one way or the other. I feel like that's a thing that probably happened, but I can't think of a good example, and so then therefore, but like the word deconstruct did have like a renaissance around that yeah. time. It's kind of the beginning of like the absolute giving over to culture of like Easter egg videos.
Yes, right. And that's exactly what I associate with this, is like the deconstructive emerges in kind of like pop cultural or fandom spaces as this way, I think, of people like branding basically like close readings and occasionally, right, and very often critical close readings, which I think are good things to do. But deconstruction carries with it this valence of like academic rigor or of a kind of maybe political orientation in some vague way for, I think, like a general public. And so I just remember reading like lots of blog posts by people saying that they were doing like deconstruction of the horror genre. And it's like really what this person is doing is like, well, close reading some horror films and like developing typologies from them, not deconstruction in mm-hmm. the way that we're talking about it here in the Derridian sense of disclosing mm-hmm. the aporias, right? The empty spaces of a structure of thinking. So I think there's some of that going on here. Well, like the pop cultural idea of deconstruction as just a general close reading or sometimes an against the grain reading. I think the first time I ever remember hearing about deconstruction at all was someone talking about Watchmen being a deconstruction of superheroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Which I think is maybe how a lot of people get to that of they look at like what Watchmen does to superhero comics and kind of like reverse engineer their own idea of what deconstruction is based on that.
Gotcha. Yeah. I was confused about the distinction you were making here. But yeah, absolutely. The word deconstruction is out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And here in Derridian deconstruction, or, you know, deconstruction as a method, it is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the word hammer meant like anything you could hit something with, but also was explicitly only like a ball peen hammer, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, it's like this fence post I have. It's a hammer. But yeah, so anyway, deconstruction is interesting.
Yeah,
as a thing. Yeah. What you want to talk about this this dyslexic girl?
Yeah. So Anna, the sort of main pony pal for this story, the owner of Acorn, has dyslexia. One of the best earliest jokes in this whole thing is when it's describing Anna, the actual novel, the text of the original novel is describing Anna. And then it's she does something or has trouble reading or something. And then it says Anna is dyslexic, which means that she has trouble reading written words or something like that. And then Dirk inserts a line that's like, she's so fucking dyslexic that when the topic comes up, the tense of this book changes.
Yes, this is the Anna. So this is the original text of the book says Anna is dyslexic. So reading and writing are difficult for her. And then that's a period. We get into the sentence and then. She is so goddamn dyslexic that the tense of this book changes when her dyslexia is being discussed. Yeah, that's the gag.
Yeah, it's a fun little throwaway joke and very much of the mode, going back to the dyslexia thing, very much of the mode of this YA fiction. I think of like the Babysitter's Club, where there's mm-hmm. like Stacy and Stacy has diabetes. Right. There's like,
does Stacy really have diabetes?
She does. Yeah.
Is that a real example?
This is revealed in the book, Stacy's Secret. And this is burned into my mind forever. Not just because like I read Babysitter's Club books when I was a kid, which I did. But the thing that locked this into my mind was in early Wikipedia, finding out that there were people who were just like cataloging all of these things, you know, mm-hmm. here's like every single Babysitter's Club book with a one sentence summary, really, you know, planting the seed in my mind for Just King things. But
or ripping us off,
ripping us off through time.
Yep.
But I just remember like reading, I was like on Wikipedia and I was like, oh my God, someone has entered in like every single Babysitter's Club book and given a one sentence summary. And just the sheer like overwhelming horror that like becomes comedy of like reading through a list of things with this very programmatic kind. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Right? Where it's like the baby disappears.
Right. And so I find I'm reading through this whole thing and then I get to Stacy's Secret and the one sentence summary is Stacy has diabetes. So it's like, oh. Well, damn, you spoiled it for me.
Yeah. God damn, Stacy's got one secret. Yeah. You stole it from her. Yeah, I would also say this is like a particular type of joke too. This feels like, I don't feel like dyslexia can be the punchline mm-hmm. of 2022.
No.
You know, I also wonder if Anna's dyslexia ever comes back in the I'm never going to read this novel, but in the original novel, or if it's just a throwaway line.
Right. Well, and that's what I mean.
You know, and it's good. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Yeah.
I mean, not that she's dyslexic. You know, I guess it's unfortunate for this fictional character. Probably makes her life harder in some ways, but I bet she's getting through it. But also, you know, it's like this YA form of like, hey, there are people in the world and they're all different.
Right. Well, and that's like, good. That's the Stacy's Secret thing, right? It's like Stacy's kind mm-hmm. of like being secretive. And when the other girls are talking, she like goes into the other room and is doing something. And it turns out like she's giving herself insulin shots or whatever, right? And that's like the story of that. There's other things going on in that plot, as I recall. But like, it that's the vibe, right? It's like, hey, you may have friends who have like these sort of life situations like dyslexia or diabetes that are strange and unfamiliar to you, but they can, like, you know, they can still be your friends and we can all be friends together, and we just have to like understand that we're all kind of different and we all have different stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. It's nice.
So I think that's where Anna's dyslexia, that's the function of Anna's dyslexia in Pony Pals, probably. That's my guess, having not read the entire series. But here in Detective Pony, it becomes her superpower, like her deconstructionist superpower, because she can misread words and make like linguistic puns.
Oh, it also like it changes her whole, because she She dies and comes back to life, right?
Yes, right. She dies.
And then, like, warps through all these different stories. She experiences, like, ego death and is, like, routed through the entirety of all texts possible.
Yeah, I can quote this. She says, I passed through all the texts surrounding this one, but I didn't go smoothly. My dyslexia made them rough, I guess. More textured, as you'd probably like to put it. The words that build them are more mutable to me, and I kept getting caught on their jagged edges. Edges that would be invisible to you, that you couldn't factor for. And so I became aware of the existence of these other texts. She's talking to Dirk, by the way. This is another example of, like, characters speaking back to their creators. When I landed back in this text, having been nudged slightly off course by those collisions, I became aware of it. I was a half step out of sync with reality, so she got langoliered. Existing partially between its very words, I imagine anyone else would have just slotted back into place and continued on the path you had set for them, but being dyslexic, I was uniquely equipped to recognize these blurry mixed up in between spaces. I kept one foot in the text, playing along, but all the while learning from it, learning about myself, finding its weaknesses, searching for its seams, and I found the seams. And then she goes on and sort of talks about how, like, every illusion that Dirk has inserted into the text, she, like, got not just that illusion, but also its context, right? She got the text behind the illusion. Anna becomes, like, this embodiment of intertextuality itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She becomes the, like, you know, did you know that reference does things?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yep. I mean, I do think I kind of wish, I don't know, I'm not super into, like, it seems clunky.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the dyslexia is superpower to do all this kind of stuff, right? Like, yeah. I don't know. It doesn't feel like this is done super well. But also, this is just a scribbling over of a children's novel. So I don't, you know, I don't know what my expectations are, really.
Right.
It very much is a hussy style move, right? Of, like, oscillating between two modes where I have to internally be like, well, am I asking too much? And then I have to read, like, a full page of, like, kind of pseudo summarized Derrida. And it's like, well, maybe I need to think harder about this. And then I see a cat shitting everywhere and have to be like, I should stop thinking about this thing. So, you know, it's hard for me to read the, like, this whole, like, textual transformation thing is, like, is it just a shit post or is it, like, a thing that I should take seriously? I guess, like, using dyslexia as, like, the mechanism is clever here. But also it doesn't go anywhere. Like, it, you know what I mean? Like, there's not any interesting output about what misinterpretation does,
right?
You know, as the function of the superpower, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of feels like it's like, all right, well, dyslexia was like an interesting platform for a joke and then an interesting platform for a superpower, and then that platform did not support anything,
right?
So a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah, it basically just means that she, like, gets some sort of kind of awareness of the interior author Dirk, and then, like, can go off track of the plot that he's already laid out, right? And then this is by the end, like, Dirk is talking with Gene Betancourt, the original writer of Pony Pals, about how he, like, plotted that out himself anyway to begin with, right? That it was all his puppeteering at the end anyhow.
Right.
Right. Which is, you know, one of the points that we've raised about Homestuck itself.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. We got it.
Yep. I mean, this is where things do get kind of interesting, because especially in that later part, there are so many discussions, like, where Gene Betancourt is talking with Dirk about, you know, like, well, why did you even make this thing? Like, you know, what have you done by effacing this book and so on? The discussion about, like, having created this thing that you have a weird ambivalent feeling about, and what do you do with that? Do you kill it? Because the question here is, like, do we take the book and, like, dip it in the river Lethe and erase all of Dirk's insertions and so on? Do you kill the thing that you created, or do you, like, let it live and sort of make decisions for yourself? This all seems to be a kind of rerouting of Dirk's conversations with and about the autoresponder in the comic, which you and I both took as kind of meta reflection of Hussey on what's going on with the Homestuck fandom. And one of the things that ends up being kind of really tricky about this is, like, I don't know to what extent, say, SonnetStuck understands that conversation about Durkin autoresponder in the same way. Is SonnetStuck using these discussions to also, like, sort of speak back to Hussey a little bit, right? Or is this purely like, oh, this is a thing that Dirk did in the comic, and now I can use it in my fan fiction in kind of this different context, right? It queries judgment once again.
Mm-hmm.
So you said earlier on that you thought that this text was actually more Heideggerian, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about that. Where do you see the Heidegger happening here?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, only in like a thin way, mm-hmm. I would say. What I mean by that is that Derrida builds on the Heideggerian project, right? He's critical of it, but he inherits and inhabits a lot of the basic criticisms that Heidegger is doing of the kind of continental project broadly, mm-hmm. the philosophical project. And the way that Heidegger does that, the way he like operates this kind of little mechanism for dealing with the history of philosophy, and sidebar, but an important sidebar, Heidegger is a Nazi. I don't engage seriously with Heidegger in any of my work. I guess he is not a Nazi. He was a Nazi. He is dead, mm-hmm. and has been for a very long time. Heidegger is notoriously complicated, but also notoriously impactful on 20th century philosophy in particular. It's kind of hard to talk about anything without figuring out that you're routing into Heidegger at some point. But the way that Heidegger makes a lot of his argumentation, the kind of engine for doing his philosophical work, is to look at the ancient Greeks and kind of assert that they are a originary point for quote unquote Western modernity. I mean, you can see some stuff creeping in here. And so in using Greek philosophy as the origin point for the vast majority of European philosophy, he says, well, look, if we look at those original decisions and we look at the original kind of argumentations that are happening there, it actually opens up a wider field of philosophy that allows us to critique our philosophical traditions proper. I mean, Heidegger is largely understood to be a massive break with European philosophy of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. And so so what I mean by that is, like, Heidegger goes back to the original Greek in order to point out ambiguities or largenesses or complexities that have fallen out of European history of philosophy. And he does that in order to say, actually, all you got to do is look at the Greeks. You know, he famously looks to the pre-Socratics. He says, look, if you look to the pre-Socratics, they tell you X, Y, Z. What if we took that as a first principle and then are kind of able to obviate the vast majority of the history of philosophy?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big thing, and that often comes through language, and that often comes through reading of a word and then pointing out the root word and then discussing the kind of originary function. You know, if you want to make fun of Heidegger, the easy way to do that is to just point out all the times in the text in which, like, miraculously the root word for something becomes the most important part of it, as if, you know, the root word of language is the key operator for all of existence, mm-hmm. right? Like, because that's something that Heidegger kind of does on face. The reason I say that is that Derrida does a similar maneuver. I mean, he's heavily influenced by Heidegger, as most of his contemporaries were. Heavily influenced there. And if they weren't influenced by Heidegger, they were influenced by trying to get around him in some way. The thing that Derrida does that is similar to Heidegger is he performs the similar maneuver. He likes to look at language and he likes to look at words, but he often likes to do a different thing with it, right? He likes to look at it and not find the commanding reality, right? So it's not the truth of the language that existed in the ancient period, in the classical period. And so then, therefore, we're able to trace to the present. For him, it's like, there was something weird going on back there. And that actually produced an ambiguity that generated some sort of problem, mm-hmm. in the current way we understand it, right? So for Heidegger, it's often clarifying to understand the linguistic root and the philosophical root. For Derrida, that almost always is the complexifying maneuver. It never makes anything more simple, and it never makes anything dealing with history less complicated. This text does the Derrida method to do the Heideggerian thing. It, you know, it likes to pull up all of the, you know, because at the point, I think toward the end, right, where we get all of the, like, the words that are in the Plato's Pharmacy mm-hmm. that Dirk used, but not the one for Sorcerer, right? All that kind of stuff.
Right.
It plays the it pretends it's doing Derridian analysis, but is actually doing something I consider much closer to Heideggerian, which is that actually the language holds all the truths and held the truth the whole time. Whereas for Derrida, that's not true.
Right.
The language will never get you there. It's always some externality that is a crucial thing that is part of it, but is not located there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a different thing going on. And also the fact that like the method provides the truth. One can think oneself to the problem in Detective Pony. What a just bonkers thing for me to be saying here. But whereas for Derrida, right, it's about inheritances, right? So that's one of the places where I really think that the philosophical part of this kind of falls apart, and where it really becomes just about narrative because of like, you know, the trace, the ash, the remnant, all of these are kind of synonymous within Derrida. And then the kind of the haunting, you know, hauntology is also a Derridian concept. The bare linguistic difference and difference, right? Mm-hmm. Like the thing going on in that language, which is accurately described in this. All of those are about talking about, or they're Derrida's way of getting into inheritance and holdover, right? Like, how can something that is not here, how can something that is not present be here nevertheless?
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, Inspectors of Marx, he applies that to Marx and looks at the commodity. How could the commodity maintain the trace of something that is not here? Where is labor?
Right.
Like, time, you know, mm-hmm. there's a reason why that begins with time is out of joint, right? Like, how could an impression of something that has been daisy chain lost, how could it still haunt the very moment that we're here? By the way, this is also my big beef with like the Mark Fisher and then inheritors of that model, right? Like the hauntology is not just like a song that plays and like you listen to a song cover and you're like, holy shit, that sounds like the original, but I don't know which one is real. You know, I don't know which one is the real one. I think Mark Fisher's work is really great. I think that his decomplexifying of hauntologies actually kind of hurts the coolness of the argument, kind of the scale of the argument in the general sense. This is my sidebar.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but all these languages about inheritances, what's around, you know, is that the ash, there are ashes, there are, is the kind of thing that happens in his book, Cinders, or not ashes, but cinders. He looks to this linguistic formulation that depending on the way you read it in French, it has two meanings that are simultaneous, and he kind of uses that to work into, well, what happens when the cinder itself, you know, this kind of like ash giving remnant that echoes on beyond its original form, where does it go? And it disseminates into language, it disperses into language, it disperses into an inaccessible presence. It's everywhere all the time and it provides a structure, but you can't touch it. You can't hold on to it. There are cinders, but that's kind of it.
With that in mind, let's talk about this ending and kind of what happens, because we've already gestured at it a couple times. Like, we get to this point of it's Dirk talking with Jean Betancourt. And it enters into a dialogue format with Betancourt's, right? Like, there no other descriptive prose is going on, no quotation marks. It becomes a dialogue in the same way that like Caliborn and Hussey speaking in the main comic is a dialogue, where it's just like lines of alternating colors for the text. Mm-hmm. Betancourt is black text and Dirk is orange. And they sort of talk through like, what is Dirk's responsibility to this weird story that he has told, and now that he has like written himself into it, like, why is he doing that? Like, you know, this is part of like what people really, I think, latch onto or like about Dirk is the I can't remember how you described it in a partisode, but something about how kind of like tortured he is and sort of interior.
He's you know, this is maybe I'm only coming to this very moment.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he's Batman. He's really a Byronic hero.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I mean, that is the thing. Like, every moment of action is met by like a thousand moments of like indecision and sadness, and people like just like a big old capital R romantic.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then so
because Batman's also a big capital R romance.
Right. And so Dirk is like that. Like his feelings are epic, right? He has defaced this children's book and sent it to his friend for her birthday, and he is having a full on like emotional breakdown in the final five pages, right? Like that's what Dirk is.
Yep.
And like, you know, sort of tying himself into knots about like what has he done to this book? And now he's like written these characters that are like self-aware or whatever, or they like seem self-aware to him. So now what does he do to them? And Betancourt is saying, you know, you've done violence to the text, but do you have control over it? Right. Violence and control. There's like a again, this is. It would be interesting to know to what degree is Sonnet Stuck kind of like aiming this at Hussey's own kind of position here as someone who has control over a narrative, but is also consistently talking about that narrative in such a way that frames it as a thing that they have no control over. Right. But then eventually, right, the choice that is arrived at. Is that rather than straight up dipping the book into the River Lethe themselves in order to erase it, Dirk hands over the like choice of resetting the book to the characters themselves. And so like we go through the whole dialogue with Betancourt and Dirk, and then we conclude with like a brief moment. Well, no, that's actually just straight up where we. So we conclude that, then we get Appendix A, mm-hmm. which is the official body count, which is just a list of all of the deaths in the book, which is fun. I like that.
Before we get there, yeah. can I point out one thing here?
Sure.
If only because someone asked us about it. Someone asked us about yes. it in the in the Discord. When they knew we were going to do this, and I think, you know, it's probably a friendly thing to do to actually address it. So this is it Gene? I know I've heard you say this a million times. Is it Gene or Jean?
I think it's Gene, but I don't know. I okay. haven't heard her name spoken aloud.
I literally did not know, mm-hmm. even though you've said the name 50 times. Mm-hmm. And maybe I've said the name. I was suddenly overcome with a worry that I was saying it wrong. Okay, this is Dirk. So Dirk, back to what you said a bit ago that I play at control. Betancourt. It was a very deliberate choice of words. Dirk. I both love and hate those nebulous literary concepts. Difference, trace, play. That one in particular has been sneaking in for a while now, becoming more and more prominent, and I have no idea what that signifies, if anything. Betancourt. I think you do. Play is something that both cannot and must be taken seriously. Either it is opposed to logos or it is the very thing that allows it to be. Play has no essence of its own and cannot be affirmed without being negated. As soon as play comes into being and into language, it erases itself as such. And isn't that, aren't all those things what this book is doing, especially now? Dirk, you mean I'm trying to have it both ways? Oh, wait, that's not a question mark. You mean I'm trying to have it both ways? I'm trying to have this book be both playful and serious and fighting against the possibility of it being playfully serious. And so it's ripping itself apart. Betancourt. Well, no, like you said, it's a nebulous concept. I just think that if you'd open yourself to the possibility of play earlier, things might have gone differently. Dirk. I should have treated this as a game, not as a game. Betancourt. Yes, precisely. Dirk. Is it a game now? Betancourt. Well, at a point, the game should appear to stop. That's when the game's rules. And that's when we can hunt down that hidden chain of signification, which you and your role as an author, if such a thing even exists, shouldn't be able to see, at least not as such. But since you're also a character, I think we can let it slide this time. What's all that mean, Michael? What do you think? Because the question we were asked, I'll clarify as you think. The question we were asked was, what does it mean when Dirk says, quote, I should have treated this as a game, not as a game? Mm-hmm. And what the first one is italicized to the text.
Well, I think one of the ways to understand this, if we like stitch it back into the conversation that we've just been having, and by we, I mean these fictional characters, right? That this is.
Yes. Oh, I'm Gene Betancourt. Like all the time.
Great.
I forgot to say that.
Well, she did write that dissertation on feminist short films, so not surprising. Yeah. Yep. That's a fun fact that comes up here, by the way. So one of the ways I think to understand how game is being used here is thinking through this insistence on like Dirk's controlling kind of qualities, right? This is another thing from the comic that is talked about or talked around, and that is being pulled in here and like put center stage. Like if we center these qualities of Dirk, that he tends to be kind of secretive, but he's like secret. He keeps information from people in order to work his own designs in the world around him. All in ways that he justifies as being to kind of like to the other people's benefit. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the ways of thinking about this is the two different games, the repetition of that term, is this a game that Dirk plays as something trivial? Right. So I should have treated this as a game, not as a game. Maybe Dirk was doing all of these things, you know, working his designs on these texts and these characters, but he was not approaching it with maybe the, let's say, ethical seriousness that such a thing might have accomplished, right? Or not accomplished, but necessitated, right? He treated it as a game in the sense of something trivial, rather than a game as a game in the sense of something that is maybe cooperative or has like multiple factors and sort of like rules that legislate it and sort of a point to it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's one way that we can read this, that we're querying like, well, Dirk, like, what was it you did when you started out writing this book? Like, were you doing it as something trivial, as just like this one off thing for Jane to read? Or is this a thing that is trivial? Is this just like a shit joke that doesn't need to be thought about too much? Happy birthday, Jane. Or is this an invitation to Jane? Let's say, let's read it within the diegesis, to like maybe get a pretty clear view of who you are as a person, right? Are you actually opening up to her here, or are you, you know, just like putting up more and more shadow shows like you constantly do?
That does make sense. And yeah, you know, in a literal sense too, the question here, in the Discord, I said, you know, game is probably kind of functioning here in the way that Difference does, right? Where it has two meanings that kind of run into one another. And the kind of critical thing here too, I think, is like, it's too long to get into in this episode, but you can go listen to our Game Study Study Buddies episode on James Hans's The Play of the World to get a sense of what all of this is going on here. So I'm basically telling you to go listen to another different 2.5 hour episode of a show, but it will give you the answer that you seek.
And that's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Signed, Gene Betancourt.
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were talking about, the body count before, before I took us back to this thing.
Yeah. Then we get the body count. It's funny. I like this joke. Just like, here's a list of every single person who died.
Minotaur.
Political prisoner, parentheses, firing squad, parentheses, metaphorical. And then the ending, right, is Pam, Pawnee, and Anna. And because Pawnee, who is a character originally in the book named Lulu, she gets renamed as the entire city of Pawnee, Indiana. One of her kind of critical things here is that as the character who has been most explicitly like replaced or rewritten, she becomes aware of her dual nature as someone who straddles both the previous text and the current version of the text. And so ultimately it is her choice about whether or not to revert to the original text or, you know, continue on in like whatever hell this is. And so the girls are kind of like wandering through this characterless landscape that is like beyond the boundaries of the plot. And Anna, the kind of protagonist, is hoping that she'll see Acorn again, because she is terrifying and murderous as Acorn is. This is a thing that we've really undersold, is that like Acorn is presented as just like this satanic figure who's like killed millions in this infinitely long life. She loves Acorn and wishes he would return. And Acorn also loves her. And she thinks she hears like hoofbeats approaching in the distance. And then that's when Pawnee made her choice. And that's where the book ends. And we get, you know, little like like publishing company flyer. And then after that, we get the first page of Detective Pony that's been pasted in from the beginning of the book, except this time it doesn't have any edits on it. And then we get this long quote from Plato's Pharmacy and then a quote from Nabokov's Pale Fire.
Yeah, Pale Fire is like all over this thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Pale Fire, if you're not aware, is a book that presents itself as like a scholarly edition of a long poem by a poet named John Shade. And it's got like, you know, a critical introduction and like footnotes and everything. And the footnotes in the introduction are written by the editor, the alleged editor of the text, who presents himself like he was a scholar in the same English department as the poet. But as you read the poem, his critical notes become longer and longer and more self-involved and kind of like more about his specific relationship with the poet and what was going on in their lives respectively. And then there becomes this like whole conspiracy thing of the poet was killed. But why did it have to do with like the lineage of succession for this foreign country that may or may not be real? And also, is the guy writing these notes possibly not mentally well, right? That is he possibly like that's a very Nabokovian thing is like, hey, what if a narrator was unreliable to the point of being like truly like mentally ill?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and that's Detective Pony.
That's it.
Yep. Pretty fun.
DP.
Oh, yeah. Good old DP. I love a good DP personally.
Oh, Michael.
Hmm?
The
director of photography, hey, Cameron. Forgot,
yeah, of course. I know, I get it. We forgot to say this. I made an allusion to it earlier. And we forgot to say it. Based on that doodly doo thing, what you call it, AMA that you looked at. Yeah. We found out that the Sonic Stuck went on to write a different thing.
Yeah,
a visual novel called Grand Ole Academy, a dating simulator for dating all of the presidential Republican presidential. You know, people in the running, the field of for the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm. That didn't work out. But the team was trying to go for it as recently as early 2020 when they were promising it would be released by August. And at that point, it was not released and all of the stuff has gone dark. There was a Kickstarter for it and the Kickstarter met its goal. And it presents itself as satirical. I don't really know what that means in this context. I'm reading from the Kickstarter here. Grand Old
It doesn't read as satirical.
Yeah. Grand Old Academy is a Japanese style visual novel slash dating sim inspired by contemporary American politics. Its tone is satirical but lighthearted. It is a story about romance, friendship, and competition, not actual political issues.
Mm.
Yeah. Think Hadofo boyfriend, but instead of pigeons, it's Republicans. Also worth underscoring here is that the player character in this is, and I'm going to read from the thing again. You are Mori America, a Japanese transfer student entering Grand Ole Academy, a prestigious private high school in the United States. So you are a Japanese woman school, like a high school student who is dating these like. Not even age down. These just look like the Republican presidential candidates. And like, just to be perfect.
Yeah, it's just Rand Paul.
Yeah, like Rand Paul's there. Like Jeb Donald Bush. Trump is there.
Yeah, it's just not. It's as they say, no bueno.
Yeah, vibes not great.
Scroll all the way down. Scroll all the way down to going with to a romantic date with Jeb at the aquarium. This is the most uncomfortable fucking thing I've ever seen
is
in
that
my
a
life. Say,
can I control F? Oh, Jesus Christ. I don't have to control F for that. But, oh, wow. Yeah, so this is... This is a paint, like a digital painting of Jeb Bush with his arm around a young Japanese woman. And they are both, like, excitedly looking at some sea turtles outside of, an aquarium walkway. Like, the ones that go underwater.
It's deeply uncomfortable. It deeply uncomfortable, bordering on gross. Mm-hmm. Like there's something about the physical size difference here. There's something about the age difference, and something about the fact that it's Jeb Bush inherently that makes this not good to me. Anyway, so that's what Sonic Stuck went on to do.
Mm-hmm.
In case you're curious about that, I'm sure maybe some other stuff too. But goddamn,
yeah. No, I. like when I was looking at the Tumblr and found out that they were going with it straight into 2020, it was like, wow, this takes some dedication considering what is happening with everything post, like, because right. the Kickstarter launches before the 2016 election, which is dubious enough. But then the fact that it continued the game, you know,
yeah.
okay, like, okay, whatever.
Yeah. Can I read a very funny thing to you?
Sure.
It's the funniest thing. I read the whole Kickstarter.
Uh-huh.
This is the funniest thing. And it's almost as funny as some of the funniest parts of Detective Pony. You ready? Okay. Risks and challenges. It's the end. While our art and music team is made out of visual novel veterans, this is the first VN for our writer and programmer. With that in mind, our planned release date may be a bit optimistic. Also, while making a game that is influenced by real-life events, there's always the risk that something may go awry in real life, which would necessitate changes to the script. If anything too major happens, it could delay the final product while tweaks are made.
Well, that is pretty funny.
It's deeply funny to me. If anything too, like the election happening?
Uh-huh.
Like all of these people being major parts of government?
Mm-hmm.
Like the detonation of the Moab in Afghanistan? Like, what the fuck, man? Mm-hmm. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. I looking at the Tumblr, a thing that was constantly freaking them out when this was still kind of being worked on was Ted Cruz grew a beard, and art assets that they made for Ted Cruz had him beardless.
This makes me want to, like, slam my hand in a car door. This makes me want to just, like, enliven my life, you know, like, reground myself in material, you know, conditions to be like, oh, the internet's not real. Mm-hmm.
Yes. God, I wish.
This makes me want to do that. This makes me want to, like, go do door-to-door activism. Go plant a turnip. You know what I'm saying? Like, this, it makes me want to disavow digital communication. Mm-hmm. I hate it.
Yes.
But I didn't hate Detective Pony. I thought it was quite fun. Yeah,
Detective Pony. Good times. Thank you so much for listening to these bonus episodes, which you are getting because you're supporting us on Patreon. That helps a lot. Consider telling some friends about us and all the cool stuff that Patreon gets you. These episodes and more. Next time, the next bonusode, we will reconvene and we will be discussing, Cameron and I, the entire run of Paradox Space, the companion, like, side comic, like, perpetual guest comic to Homestuck that has been discussed very recently on the mainline episodes. And Cameron and I are going to read all the Paradox Space comics and talk about them. So look forward to that.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to check that out. And you know, we're still making decisions about what the next show is after Homestuck. So if you have ideas about that, of course, I guess you're on Patreon. Leave a little comment in the Patreon thing. We don't know yet. There's some front runners, but we haven't made a decision yet.
All right. Well, we don't have a sign off for these. So goodbye.
Goodbye.